Listen up, all you New York fans. Veteran New York sports talk host John Jastrzemski gives his unique take on all the big stories in the Big Apple and beyond, including guest conversations, gambling picks, and reactions from you, the listener. Check out New York, New York with John Jastrzemski on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
David, what's on your mind today?
This is breaking news. As we record this, it'll be old news by the time people hear it because, you know, things move quickly. But apparently, Rudy Giuliani and his son, one of those times where it's not a great idea to have ridden daddy's coattails, have been banned from Fox News or have gotten a 3-month ban. It's a little bit unclear when the ban started. Maybe I just missed it. And the Daily Beast piece frames it as if Giuliani had just found out today that he was banned with the rest of us. But according to Rolling Stone, which is the link that's being most widely circulated out there, Giuliani has been banned from Fox News for 3 months. Oh, this is according to Politico. Okay, so Politico had this first. The Politico report says Giuliani was slated to appear on Fox's 20th anniversary coverage, but host Pete Hegseth called him the night before to tell him he'd been cut and apologize, according to Politico. The ban, network bookers have been told, comes from the top and extends to Giuliani's son, Andrew, who is running for governor of New York. Fox News spokesperson denied Andrew Giuliani had been banned from the network and denied that Rudy Giuliani was scheduled to appear on Fox and Friends on 9/11. But Fox News declined to comment on whether Rudy Giuliani is banned from appearing on the network in general.
Okay.
That's a pretty... you know, it's a very interesting state of affairs right now, right? I mean, this is like Fox is still out there running. I mean, as functionally as a, you know, still sort of like Trumpist platform, although other places have tried to take over that territory. But because of, you know, the Dominion lawsuits and probably assorted other things, they are determined to say as far away from the big election lie as they can. Is that what, am I reading that correctly?
Well, I've got a couple reactions here that I think will address your questions. Number one, came from the top. Sounds very tinkling piano 1920s. This came right from the top.
It's
Chief
also,
says no
it's
more
also
appearances.
It's the greatest excuse too. When someone's just like, what the hell do you mean I'm banned? Just be like, sorry, Rudy, this came right from the top. It's something that only a 70 something or 80 year old man would just take as gospel and think that was enough to end the conversation. Right. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It came right from the top. Oh, sorry. I didn't realize it came from the top. I'm sorry that I'm talking to you about it. Yeah. I mean, that's great.
Also, Rudy Giuliani being banned from Fox News. What was the line that was traversed now versus everything Rudy Giuliani did?
Well, I think it came out on Tuesday, right? That there were leaks from the Trump campaign's internal memos that they knew that all the Dominion stuff was false when they were promoting it, right? So that, yeah. I don't know if that's enough to change Fox's mind, but that's enough to, and I saw somewhere that Fox didn't even report on that. But I mean, unsurprisingly, I guess.
Yeah, but we're drawing the line here. That's it. You know, we've now you've done it. Now you have gone too far.
Any notion of plausible deniability, I guess, is out the window now, right? Because you can't, I mean, if.
But come on. Come
yeah. Well, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. The other thing is 3 months. So it's like a PED suspension in baseball.
I don't understand. Yeah. Right. So like the Dominion lies were his unfair advantage over the other talking heads on the network.
But in three months, it'll be okay. We will understand
months,
that
they'll cycle
learned
out of the
your
system.
Lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like none of this is serious in any sort of meaningful way, but it does seem really ridiculous, right? That if someone's coming on your network and lying and you have an issue with their lying, I think the appropriate thing to do is to say, don't do this again or you're fired for good, or you fire them for good, right? You don't say like, don't do this totally unethical, problematic thing, and we'll give you 3 months in the corner to think about it.
Yeah, and then return to our air with your typical dispassionate political analysis. Everything will be just fine.
Yeah. Yeah, you just got to wait for time to pass, I guess, with this, right? Hopefully he'll be interested in talking about some other lie when he comes back.
Coming up on today's show, David, we talk about Gabby Petito coverage, we talk about NFL insiders and gambling, and how not to interview an Emmy winner seconds after they won an Emmy. All that and more on the Press Box, a part of the Ringer Podcast Network. Hello, media consumers. Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker of The Ringer here, along with producer Erica Cervantes. David, it's Friday, so let's do a little listener mail to roll into the weekend.
Let's do it.
And a subject comes up from Gabe Hernandez that I've been wanting to talk to you about. Gabe asks, was the coverage of Gabby Petito too much?
Well, was, I'm not sure is the correct word there. I think is the question. I mean, there's a lot of different factors at play in the story, but also in answering the question. Has Gabby Petito's disappearance and death been covered too much, as opposed to in mainstream news to the detriment in terms of coverage space and time to other stories? Yes. I mean, in so much as it's taken time away from other subjects. Yeah. And, you know, obviously this spins directly into a conversation about taking airspace away or occupying a certain amount of space that every other significant disappearance and murder doesn't get, right? Particularly of people of color. I do think there's sort of a secondary piece of this that is just evidence of mainstream kind of traditional news sources trying to compete in the internet age. There will be people getting the same number of clicks on Gabby Petito stories on Twitter and on the internet, if it's not NBC News or whoever. And obviously the mainstream outlets are in competition with those sorts of, like, you know, fly by night sources even more directly now. The way I understand it, and this could be totally wrong, but the story was actually got national attention because of one of the billion crime podcasts out there that sort of identified the story and started blowing it up in the very early days. And all it really takes is, you know, that sort of kernel of attention, and this isn't the first time our entire national focus has seemed to hone in on the disappearance of, you know, a blonde white girl. It's not the first time our entire national attention has been focused on something that is, like, in retrospect, incredibly insignificant but gripping at the time. I mean, there's a lot of sort of potential meat to the story, and I think that in a world of you know, where there are more crime podcasts than newspapers, it makes sense that this is the sort of thing that would, you know, to see a story like that evolving in real time, it makes a lot of sense that this is as big a deal as it is in a certain way. But I think what's really interesting and potentially hopeful about it is that the story is like it's two parallel stories that are existing at the same time. One is the disappearance and death of a potential murder of Gabby Petito, and one is how outsized the coverage of her has been compared to the hundreds and thousands and potentially millions of missing women of color and just generally other people who don't normally get this sort of media attention. And that story has really taken over the Gabby Petito story, that it's almost impossible to pay attention to one without paying attention to the other. And so, in some sense, the very fact that it's too much, that she's getting too much airtime, might have a positive outcome.
Because it draws attention to the discrepancy in coverage between one and the other. This is what the late Gwen Ifill called missing white woman syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that the media latches onto particular stories. Katie Robertson wrote a really good story in the New York Times about it. Quoting here, the disappearances of people of color tend not to generate the same volume of media interest, despite their occurring at a higher rate. A report from the University of Wyoming found that 710 indigenous people were reported missing from 2011 to 2020 in that state, which is where Ms. Petito's remains were found. I'd also like to come back to a sentence you uttered a few minutes ago, which may be one of the most depressing things I've ever heard. There are now more true crime podcasts than newspapers.
Well, I don't know that to be true, but I would bet money that it's true.
That is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. There are more true crime podcasts than newspapers. Because what we need to educate the public in America, what we need to get information is a true crime podcast.
Yeah.
The only thing I would push back on is when you talk about mainstream media retrenching to try to compete with Twitter and said podcasts. Cable news has kind of been here for a long time, right?
Oh, for sure. That's not giving them a pass.
Dateline NBC kind of helped create this modern genre going back, even network news with JonBenet and all these other things, Nancy Grace. And, you know, I mean, there's this to me is one of those things where I look at this and this coverage seems awful and completely disproportionate. It also feels like a rerun of everything that's been happening for decades in American media.
Yeah, I do think that I guess the point that I was trying to make, because I completely agree, is just that, like, the question is it getting too much coverage? And I guess there's a sense in which that is answered by the amount of attention, the amount of viewers that the story gets, the amount of interest there is in the story. And I think there would be the same amount of interest, however you define it, because of the endless amount of outlets that could be covering it. There would be the same amount of interest, even if the mainstream outlets decided not to cover it, right? I mean, that's the only distinction I'm making there, and maybe it's a small one. Because you're right, the coverage, I mean, Dateline NBC and shows of its ilk have done more to sort of normalize and codify the way these stories are told, really to the detriment of reality and, you know, missing people of color, indigenous people, all that. I mean, every story is the same, right? And they're all told in these incredibly deceptive rote ways, you know. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that if this were not a young white couple that the boyfriend who returned under a cloud of suspicion, I can't imagine that they'd be putting up happy couple shots of them at every moment in the news, right? Usually you see these things where they find the glamour shot of the missing person and find some way to portray the man, you know, in a negative light, if he's the suspect, if it weren't this sort of like happy white cornbread couple, whatever, or white bread couple.
Yeah, he is officially, or he is a person of interest, according to the New York Times.
The whole thing is just is sort of paint by numbers at this point. And I don't know that it does anybody justice, except, as I said, with the growing realization that is what it is.
When you join legacy media's longtime obsession with these kind of stories, with the true crime podcast, and by the way, the obligatory Netflix 3-part, 5-part, 7-part documentary, which is almost always true crime. There is just too much of this. Yeah. I content creators out there, if you're trying to do upscale Dateline, maybe just do something else.
Yeah.
There is so much of this. Some of it undoubtedly is good. I try to avoid almost all of it because I'm just not interested in true crime as the singular genre of everything.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, did you see this crazy murder that was recreated in a Netflix doc? I don't care. I don't know. I didn't see that. I don't ever want to see that. And for the big boys here, this is from Katie Robertson's story. The New York Times published a breaking news story and a live briefing and sent a news alert to subscribers. About the Gabby Petito case. New York Times, which is just raking in subscription money, which now I saw in a tweet this week has more subscribers in Dallas than the Dallas Morning News does. Why are you chasing these clicks? What possible interest do you have in sending a news alert about Gabby Petito to subscribers? That just seems so dumb.
And not just that, but they should be out there heavily promoting the sort of meta pieces about it if they're going to cover it at all, right? There's important stories to be told on this subject that aren't the breaking news alerts about moment by moment, you know, minutia in the case.
Yeah. And again, recommend Katie Robertson's piece on that, which goes through a lot of the numbers and criticism of this particular genre. I want to direct you to a totally different story, David. It's in Bloomberg. It's by Timothy L. O'Brien, fine writer and Donald Trump biographer. He was writing about ESPN and gambling, and really could be writing about all of sports media and gambling and those two worlds sort of coming together. Here's a paragraph. At least one of ESPN's most high-profile employees is interested in gambling, too. Adam Schefter, a prominent on-air analyst designated by the network as an NFL insider, recently invested in Boom Entertainment, a maker of sports and casino gambling apps that is also developing what it describes as real money gaming products. One of Schefter's co-investors in Boom is Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots football team and other sports ventures. Current and former gambling, sports, and broadcast executives and companies are also investors. So O'Brien then asks ESPN, well, wait a second. What is it? Is that okay for him to be a co-investor? And what's the deal? And ESPN basically said no comment to everything, which is interesting. Now,
yeah,
that paragraph is written in such a way that I'm not quite sure what co-investor means here. It seems like there's something of a difference between Robert Kraft and Adam Schefter getting together to invest in something versus them just investing in the same company.
Yeah, and I know we're kind of coming at this from the media side here, but Robert Kraft investing in it seems like a giant story in and of itself, right? I mean, we know that when new owners bid to join a league, right, either to buy a team or to buy the rights to a new franchise, there's a lot of scrutiny into their background, how they make their money and everything else. I don't know that this would be disqualifying. There's a lot of, you know, tech arena investors in professional sports right now that are probably have a lot of different investments and things that could be seen as problematic in different ways. But it does raise the question, right? If you buy into a team and you have a clean resume, then at that point, are you free just to like invest all your money in Caesar's Palace and or like Caesar's Sportsbook? And I mean, is there any oversight at that point? I honestly don't know, but it does seem like it. I think that in a lot of ways, the media companies and the sports put themselves in this position by trying to pretend that gambling didn't exist for as long as they did. It's kind of, you know, it seems like you could draw you could make a pretty clear rule, right, about what people are allowed to do and not be in all this hazy territory. But it sort of all came on, as we discussed recently with the NFL Network taking on a gambling content. It just all kind of came as a tidal wave at once, because it was like people were just putting, you know, their fingers in their ears and their toes in the dam as it was breaking waiting for it to be, you know, I guess you're waiting for it to be inevitable, which doesn't give you a lot of time to worry about oversight.
Well, the Supreme Court decision comes down in 2018 and everybody goes, hey, money.
Yeah.
There's some money.
Yeah.
Let's retrench and get some gambling content in here.
Mm-hmm.
The NFL most recently by hiring Rachel Bonetta. I mean, it's interesting that there's not like this. Again, this is from the O'Brien piece. I asked the network, meaning ESPN, if it had a conflicts of interest policy outlining ethically acceptable investments for its employees. It declined to say whether a policy exists, and if one does, whether Schefter's Boom Investments comports with it. Okay. It seemingly would be nice to have some clarity about that question.
Well, yeah, it would be nice. I mean, listen, they're also in a weird position. I'm sure Adam Schefter is being very handsomely compensated by ESPN, but there's a lot of people of his profile and even lower who, at this moment in time, might have more value to a gambling company than they do to ESPN, right? And at some point, ESPN's going to say, do we want the Adam Schefter or whoever it is, do we want Personality X to leave for DraftKings, or do we want to let him do DraftKings on the side and keep him on our airwaves?
I am so glad you brought us there, because doesn't it feel inevitable that one of the major quote-unquote insiders will go over to the gambling company?
Yeah.
We've had journalists go work over there. We've certainly had content, sponsored by, it was at DraftKings, that's a big sponsor of the new Lebatard Meadowlark Media Enterprise. Yeah. But when is the inevitable moment when one of the big insiders is going to go work for the gambling company? Because the stuff the insider knows is the stuff gamblers want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff they want to know first. And what if they could know it, you know, a couple of minutes before the rest of humanity?
I mean, I don't even think it has to be. I mean, I think yes, yeah, absolutely true. I don't even think it has to be that gambling specific. I mean, there's got to be some number at which it makes sense for DraftKings to just hire Woj, right? We're going to give Woj $50 million a year because his content is not reliant on his institution. He's proven that. He is the font of his own, he's his own empire, no matter what banner is on above him. And then every time you see a Woj tweet, there's a DraftKings ad. You know, he's wearing a DraftKings shirt in the video, like whatever. Like, that's got to be
maybe a
value.
A nice tie, yeah.
Right? I mean, that is more straightforwardly monetizable than the way ESPN is making money off of him right now. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, agree.
They're trying to figure out the way to make him, to monetize him but let him keep tweeting. It'd be really easy to be like, for him just to be like, you know, LeBron James got traded to the Knicks. And go place bets on DraftKings. You know, I mean, like that's, if that was in every tweet, that would be great for them.
Yeah. Or if I have my DraftKings or whatever it is app and I get a push alert every time he has a scoop of any magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it doesn't matter how big or small the scoop is.
Yeah.
I always laugh when some of the insiders have the most insignificant stuff, but guess what? It's all significant if it's a company that does gambling. That feels like it's going to happen in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, you and I have talked so many times about how it blows my mind in a way that the insider has become the preeminent figure in sports media. It's new in our lifetimes that person mm-hmm. would become the thing the world revolves around rather than the columnist or the commentator, whatever. Now with gambling, their power, if anything, has been enhanced.
Yeah.
Their value has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you say, with ESPN, it's like, wow, if Schefter and Woj are tweeting, what are we getting out of all these tweets other than kind of, you know, interest in ESPN by proxy? But if you can harness those tweets and that information, that's already valuable. Just what we needed, right, David, was to make that figure more valuable in our sports media world. It is. That's wild. That's wild. Very, very funny. And like I said, I think that domino is going to fall pretty soon. David, we're going to hear the worst question you could possibly ask someone who has just won an Emmy. But first, the overword Twitter joke of the week, where we celebrate a gag that was so obvious that all of media Twitter made it at exactly the same time. Send your nominees to @thepressboxpod, where they are always gratefully received. Twitter video from New Orleans this week, David. Had the roof of the Superdome, the Saints Stadium, on fire and emitting a cloud of smoke. It was an overworked Twitter joke to write, I thought the Cardinals picked the next Pope, not the Saints.
Wow, that's really good.
There were a couple of variations, but that I thought got the closest to sheer perfection. Thanks to our friend Scott Kushner, Mike Rosenberg, Grantland Ran, Record Teacher, and not Chester Lemon for that. David, a truly amazing tweet from the Des Moines Register this week. The world's whitest paint has been created in a lab at Purdue.
Oh, God. How white was it?
Oh, glad you asked. It was an overworked Twitter joke to say, this paint is so white, it tried to use an expired Red Lobster coupon at Applebee's. This paint is so white, it'll talk over everyone in poli-sci class. And finally, this paint is so white that CNN is sending reporters to Midwest Diners Weekly to ask the paint how it feels about Donald Trump. Thanks to Eric for that one. And finally, David, one of the best gags I have ever seen in this feature. Just so perfect. The story was this. They unveiled the uniforms for the U.S. Space Force. Is the Space Force just inevitable? I'm sure there's been an explainer about this. We couldn't just cancel Space Force.
I thought that he had read. Well, I guess not.
There was a uniform reveal. Whether there's actually going to be Moonraker style space combat. We did the uniform reveal of Space Force. And I don't know if you saw the pictures of this, but no. The uniforms look very ill-fitting and untailored. Just kind of like roomy 90s style pants
mm-hmm.
rather than the crisp and tight fits you usually see with a military uniform.
I can get behind that.
A couple people took a whack at the best joke, but it was a superb, overworked Twitter joke to write. In space, no one can hem your seams.
Wow.
No one can hem your seams.
That's really good.
Thanks to Alexander Frost for that one. If you took us to the final frontier of punnage, congrats. You made the overworked Twitter joke of the week.
This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems since everything you need is on OneSuite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be and try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
All right, David, more listener mail. This from Sostradamus. On the Manning cast, are they cutting guests early if it's clear they're not great on TV? Did you watch week two of Peyton and Eli Manning
calling Monday Night Football? I watched some of it, yeah.
So it was a little weird. Brett Favre was, I think, supposed to be in the first quarter. And I don't know if this was a joke or not, but there were some internet problems down at the Favre estate in Mississippi, so he only appeared later, and then some of the guests had to be shortened and everything like that. I found that the Manning cast is really, really good. The guests, on the other hand, of the Manning cast can be really good or really boring.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea why Brett Favre is put on television anymore. I understand Brett Favre is famous. I understand he is Brett Favre. Brett Favre is no good. Like, yeah. Brett Favre is bad at TV. They looked at him for Monday Night Football a couple years ago. There's a reason they didn't hire him. Not good. Not good TV.
Maybe he's better on Zoom, you know? Who knows?
I did look up, and I had this vague memory that this had happened, and it was true that there was a study recently that said that cheese, one of these just ridiculous medical studies, that said cheese was actually very healthy for you, and Tucker Carlson had Brett Favre on to talk about the healthful properties of cheese because, you know, Packers, cheeseheads, that
yes,
really happened.
I get it.
That's all I got for you. I love this question from Matt Williams. Can we discuss the pronunciation of Sopranos and how it changed from like the music term to Sopranos, kind of like Kabul and Kabul, etc.? So as media members, have we changed the way we pronounce the Sopranos?
Yeah, do we have to? I mean, they always said it on the show, like Soprano, more or less, at least when they were saying it. But there was a certain, it feels like they did kind of go back and forth. Like it was like he was called Tony Soprano and certain, like, you know, by people who didn't know better. But in the family, it was Soprano, right? I'm just imagining that.
That's right. I do. I'm just so fascinated by this where everybody at the same time decides to change.
Yeah.
sometimes they're changing to the correct thing. Sometimes they're changing to the wrong thing, but they all change at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there some kind of bat signal put out? Is there like a long form podcast that's sort of correcting everybody?
Well,
what is
one, I think it's like anything else in non-fictional and like, you know, real human beings. Usually when someone finds a more accurate pronunciation, then it does get around really quickly that we've all been pronouncing it wrong and people, you know, maybe hypercorrect, but they correct. But especially, but in fiction, I mean, nonfiction, but especially in fiction, there's also the sort of insularity of the conversation, right? That everybody who, like the everybody who is pronouncing it the new way is, that you're referring to, is probably a TV host or a podcast host that spends most of their time listening to other podcasts or watching other television shows. Mm. So when somebody says it one way, then I think an unusual way that turns out to be right, I think it kind of, you know, that's the now, that's the common language of the conversation that is going on behind the scenes.
So first the true crime podcast were at fault for everything that's wrong with this country. Now it's the TV recap podcast.
I don't think there's anything wrong with pronouncing Soprano the correct way. So, you know, I'm not saying anyone's at fault here.
I got a clip for you, David. Sunday night was the Emmys, and Gillian Anderson, the wonderful Gillian Anderson, won an award for playing Margaret Thatcher in The Crown. Anderson was doing the post-game interview with journalists, and I want you to listen to this question.
Just to kind of continue with the whole Margaret Thatcher thing, first question, have you talked to her about this role at all? And secondly, why do you think it has taken America so long to get a female leader? You know, when all of these other countries, and look at what Margaret did in the UK.
Well, I have not spoken to Margaret.
Yeah. Margaret Thatcher left this astral plane in 2013. So Gillian Anderson has not spoken to her about playing her on the new season of The Crown. Now, what was funnier? That question, have you talked to somebody who is not alive or fishing around for the soundbite about when are we going to get a female leader in the United States after the Emmy? Totally valid question.
I just love it.
I don't know at that moment that is the most germane thing to be asking after the Emmys, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels like a reporter's workshopping a question in real time, like it just occurred to them and they weren't expecting. It's like when the waiter asks you what you want for dinner and you really hoped that your wife would order first so you'd have more time to think about it. But then you hear someone like talk about, ask someone if they were in communication with a dead person, and then you're like, yeah, you really didn't do your homework on this one.
And we think Gillian Anderson is trying to be really polite there.
I think Gillian Anderson is in real time trying to make sure. I think she is actively Googling Margaret Thatcher and when she died. I think that's the hesitation that you're there. You're like, I'm fairly certain this woman is no longer alive, but I was just asked a question by a reporter that leads me to believe otherwise. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and she's also trying to be very kind. Yeah.
It did feel like, yes, it did have the sense of, I know this is true, but it is so out of context and so unexpected.
Yeah.
That it makes me sort of wonder whether what I know is right is actually right.
Yes. Like we were all struck with that when we heard it. We're like, wait a second.
Related question from Jay Schnabel. How do members of the media consume all this content? With kids, work, and life obligations, it seems impossible to watch all these games and prestige TV series. Do media members schedule time during work hours to watch, or they talk about content they didn't actually watch? I'd like to refer Jay's question to other Ringer podcast hosts who seem to be able to watch every movie, every television series, every award show, every important sporting event. I don't know how they do it. I'm amazed.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
Because yeah. You and I don't watch everything.
No. No.
We aspire to watch everything in some imaginary
world.
Well,
in some ways, yeah. It would be nice to have watched everything. It's like what they always say about writing, right? It's wonderful to, it's fun to have written. It's never fun to write. It's sometimes fun to watch the stuff, but it'd be nice to be able to just say you've watched it all.
If you commit yourself to sports, to like every big game or just about every big game, there's really not a ton of time left.
Who do you think spends more time at their job if they're not cutting corners or if they're not lying about what they're doing? Is it at this point, is it NFL, if it's NFL coach, head coach versus national sports radio personality?
Who spends more time working on their craft?
Who spends more time working?
It's got to
be. Like NFL coaches famously work like 20 hours a day during the season sometimes or whatever. I mean, there's definitely got to be the really good national media, I mean, national TV and radio personalities, but you got to have the game is on every moment you're awake.
You're saying because they have to watch every game, not just the game they're playing in.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may be. I mean, I think NFL coaches win with just office time.
Yeah.
Because you're just kind of sitting around in a room a lot, which I don't get a sense that media members are in quite the same way. But to keep up with everything, yeah, they're probably watching more just tonnage of sports and probably working all the time. Those insiders we talk about do not seem to sleep. Or do not say, let's say they sleep, but they don't not work when they're awake. From the Department of Amplification, David. The other day we were groping around for what to call Bob Woodward's house in Washington, D.C. We have been advised that the correct term is not row house, not townhouse.
Oh, right. Okay.
Real estate
agent.
I
knew I was missing something there.
Real estate agent Brian Evans writes, townhouse tends to imply suburbs and HOA fees. Which is a good one.
I'm glad that we got an actual real estate agent on here. It makes me feel a whole lot better about this conversation. So yeah, townhouse is like a development. Like where my mom, literally where my mom is moving right now is into a townhouse.
I think specifically in the Washington, D.C. context.
Oh, okay.
Because in Brooklyn, you would say townhouse, would you not?
I'd say brownstone and then or townhouse. I'm sorry, brownstone. Brownstone, and if it's not literally a brownstone, you can say townhouse, I think. Or row house.
I think there are other places where townhouse would be what you're talking about, meaning house in the city.
Okay. Well, it's row house.
Yeah. Row house doesn't sound quite as fancy. Maybe Brian Evans will write in again.
Do you think Bob Woodward ever says, come to my row house?
No. No. I don't think so either. You don't think he asks important policymakers, can you come over to my row house? You want to drop by my row house?
No. He probably uses a fancy like French term for his home.
Sorry, that was unnecessarily snarky. It doesn't feel like Bob Woodward. Michael Wolff, maybe I would accept that, but not Bob Woodward seems to be more straightforward than that. Anyway, thanks to Brian and Brett Anthony Collette for the advice there. Our only in journalism word of the day, David. Spate. Spate.
Ooh.
Often used in journalism, very rarely used in normal language.
A spate of murders.
You never say spate.
A spate.
You always try to talk yourself into the fact that you've used this, but I've been talking to you nonstop since you were 14 years old. You do not use the word spate.
Yeah.
If you did, you'd be imitating a newscaster.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, it's time. Thanks to Shane Nyman, by the way, for spate. And it's time for David Shoemaker guesses the strained pun headline.
Yeah.
Monday's headline about the closure of a local bean factory was beans to an end. Today's headline comes from Daniel Miller. It's from the Chicago Sun-Times, David. It's a preview of the upcoming Cook County Assessor's Race, something I know you've been following very closely. The race will feature Fritz Kagi, who is the incumbent, versus Kerry Steele. What was the Chicago Sun-Times' strained pun headline?
Well, there's so much to work with here. Fritz Steele, Kagi Kerry. Assessor.
Fritz Kagi versus Kerry Steele.
Kagi Steele. Fritz.
Just think about those surnames.
Fritz and
when they run against each other,
it's
right up your alley, bud.
God, why can't a Kagi? Oh, Fritz.
No, just surnames. Kagi and Steele.
Yeah, Kagi.
When they run against each other, it's a
Kagi match. A Steele Kagi match.
A Steele Kagi.
Is that right? Oh my gosh.
Steel Kagi match.
That's great.
He is David Shoemaker. I'm Brian Curtis. Production magic by Erica Cervantes. We got another cool books pod coming up. Another book with a place of honor on the Curtis Literary Journalism bookshelf. Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, David. Superb piece. of reporting.
Absolutely good. It's a great book.
It turned 20 years old this year, and I thought about it a lot during the pandemic when the coronavirus was spreading so rapidly at those meat plants. And something that those health and safety effects that Schlosser talked about became very relevant again. Anyway, Eric Schlosser joins us to tell us how he wrote the book. Plus, more lukewarm takes about the media. See you then, David.
See you later, Brian.